coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Hello, everybody. Hello, hello. Welcome to episode 74. 74. Doesn't seem like we have been on the air in this incarnation that long. It does not seem like that long ago that we were dudes and beer and receiving that news and politics trophy over there. Make sure and go and vote for us in the upcoming People's Choice Podcast Awards, folks. We could not have done it that year without y'all's support out there sharing the story, sharing the show, sharing our Facebook group, everything else. That is what brought us to the top of that category, as well as covering stories like the Minneapolis police hack with Anonymous, them coming on and taking over the airwaves for that one episode, and numerous news stories that we carry on here regularly, the whistleblowers like Robert Duncan that are coming on the show soon, good folks like Dr. John Hall. Speaking of which, here's my Limbaugh, as always. let's take a look. Here is the upcoming pre-release schedule, just so you know, everybody. I am going on the road coming up here literally at about 5:36 a.m. in the morning for 4 weeks. But you can see we have some fantastic episodes. Tonight we have Jason Hewlett from We Want to Believe, a paranormal show out of the Canada area, as well as Dan Duke, a fellow Texan who is relative of the past Jesse James, and we will be talking with him tonight in our pre-recorded session about a lost treasure from the Knights Templar that may be buried here in Texas by Jesse James. We'll be getting into that next week. Our Falk Monster coverage is coming up. That's right, folks. Episode 75 coming to you live from the Falk Monster Festival. We had some great guests on for that, man. We had Chester Moron from Dark Outdoors talking about the Rainy Street murders over the last couple of years and their connection to the Smiley Face killings that happened across the country in the greater Northeast, Northwest of America, as well as, if I'm not mistaken, parts of British Columbia. But we'll be talking with him about that in that episode and be having him on later in a full one. We also have Jeff Crypto Hulk Stewart on. We also feature a fantastic artist, who we happened to meet out there this last week. And that was Saffron Cannon. She wrote a book, a children's book called Only 6 Feet Away. It is actually a children's story about the Falk Monster, about two kids whose friendship was forged searching for the Falk Monster. Good for her for carrying on traditions, for carrying on oral traditions here in the United States. Stop on by her page, folks, Art by Saffron Cannon on Facebook, and order your copy. Speaking of Facebook, let's go ahead and scroll on down our group there for the news of the week. News of the week is always brought to you by our Facebook group. DailyMail.uk, aliens could contact Earth using signals from mobile towers. There's one more 5G one for you. Here's a pretty interesting one out of LiveScience.com. Giant phallus-shaped iceberg floating in Conception Bay surprised residents of Dildo, Canada. That's the headlines that you just cannot make up. Out of CNN.com, vampire straw confiscated from traveler at Boston airport. That's out of CNN. Out of NBC News, 7 people found dead in Oklahoma during search for missing teens. And out of fizz.org, machine learning model sheds light on how brains recognize communication sounds. That is just some of the news that is fit to print, folks, there on our Facebook group. Stop on by and join us. That is the Curious Realm group on Facebook. Thousands of people there sharing articles, opinions, opening conversations on hard to broach topics. Of course, while you are online, checking out our Facebook group, joining our conversation, stop on by CuriousRealm.com. That is the website for CuriousRealm.com/store. That's where you can find all the books, like I Want to Believe, the book by our guest, Jason Hewlett. Jason Hewlett, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Welcome to the show. I have your book right here in my hand. I've had the pleasure of reading the first part of it today, and I love reading and hearing people's personal stories. We had a chance to talk for a minute or two before we hopped on air today. Let's go ahead and get into things. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be involved with the paranormal to begin with.
Well, my story is very similar to most people who kind of investigate and research the paranormal. You know, you have experiences when you're young, and it kind of opens your mind that there's stuff going on around you that can't easily be explained. So you start looking into it. And I've spent most of my life doing that, you know, casually at first. And then kind of as things started to happen more and more, and I got older and I kind of developed a skill set, I started kind of investigating on my own. And my first investigation was like a good 20 years ago when I went back to university to get a degree in journalism because I was a journalist, professional journalist, crime reporter for 10 years. And in one of the classes I took, it was a magazine writing class, and you had a whole semester to write one magazine article. And I figured, here's a good opportunity to take my interest in the paranormal and do something with it. So I decided to write an article for the Fortean Times, which is one of the big publications out of the UK.
That's a huge one.
It's huge. I figured, why not aim high right away, right? So there's a place in my hometown called Tronchiel Sanitarium, and it was a former tuberculosis clinic turned mental institution that shut down in the 80s when they kind of decommissioned all these asylums and sort of let all the patients out. And as soon as it shut down, the stories started, right? You know, the urban legends about it. And so I happened to know the guy who was the caretaker of the property at the time, and I asked him if I could come and investigate, and he said, sure. And so I got kind of had myself, I found like a skeptic, a psychic, someone to be a camera person, and someone who had an experience out there. And we went and basically spent the whole night investigating this facility. And you know, nothing really happened, but it was a lot of fun, and it kind of whet the appetite to do more of that. So I did that casually for a number of years, putting it on the wayside when I was a professional journalist, because back then, your integrity would be called into question if you started talking about how much you're interested in ghosts, right? Like, it just wouldn't fly.
What?
And then once the early 2000s,
because it wasn't. I can't even imagine.
I can't now either. But back then it was just kind of like, don't talk about it.
Even now, dude, right? I would love to say that stigma is gone, Jason. It isn't.
No, I'm sure it's not. Yeah. Right. It's a little more mainstream now, like, yeah, all the shows and all that kind of stuff.
Definitely say, like, you could definitely sneak one into Wired. Hey.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right. Or even around Halloween, like our group gets called on Halloween to be on TV and on radio and all that
kind of stuff.
But it's
still exactly
kind of taboo as a mainstream occupation. So it wasn't until 2017, that I realized the Paranormal Society, which is out of Vancouver, British Columbia, a few hours from where I live, was doing a membership drive because they had an interior chapter, and I decided to apply. It was right around Halloween. And that's when I met Peter Wren, who you know, I now co-form the Canadian Paranormal Society with. We've written our books, We Do, We Want to Believe. And so I started investigating with them and became like a society director and a lead investigator. And in 2020, sort of when the pandemic hit, Peter was now located in the same city where I am, which is Kamloops, British Columbia. We formed our own group and went off on our own. And that's kind of my little journey in a nutshell, right? Starting from experiences that I remember when I was five, leading kind of right up to now, where we were investigating all over Western Canada, and recently went even down to Idaho to do some investigating, and are kind of writing books and doing web shows and even doing a little bit of podcasting on our own, like everyone else seems to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard not to in this day and age. It really is a form of media, B, a form of journalism. Like, I never thought that me just doing my show the way I do my show, Jason, that I would win over Reuters.
Right?
I beat out the Reuters podcast for my news and politics award.
Which is fantastic. And I think it's great.
With a show named Dudes and Beer.
Do that.
With a show named Dudes and Beer.
Even better.
It wasn't even named Curious Realm. Those dudes of beer.
That's awesome.
So it's like, wow. The fact that, yes, I am, quote, citizen journalist. Absolutely. It's a different day and age. The day that I got my first press pass as Dudes and Beer, I was like, wow. Wow, because I'd worked broadcast. I'd been a broadcast engineer. I'd been a broadcast cameraman, all kinds of stuff. You know, like I've had my fair share of press passes. I've gone through Secret Service background checks to get badges for shows I work. Yeah, no, it was suddenly, wow, no, I am legitimately a journalist.
And I think that's the, you know, the reality that we're in. I mean, and yeah. There's a whole conversation about that now, whether it's always good or always bad, et cetera, and proper accreditation, sure. And so on. But the fact that everybody has the opportunity to get their message out there, like we were talking about before the show, their message out there their way. We're talking about, like, you know, self-promotion, right?
Yeah.
You're now in control of your own brand. Which I think is great. And if you're in the paranormal realm, because it's so diverse and there's so many different approaches. And what we try to do is we try to take a very much scientific approach. Like, we're not the guys running around screaming there's demons everywhere and all that kind of stuff, like, or getting possessed every week.
Yeah.
You know, like we take a very serious, as scientific as possible approach to what we do. And we think that's a message that's not getting out there in a lot of this media surrounding the paranormal.
No, precisely. Like I was just at the Falk Monster Festival this last weekend. My brother, love you, Randy. Thank you so much for coming out and helping with everything. My brother came with me, and as somebody who owned a retreat company himself and spent years and years working with junior high and high school students, first thing he said as we took a break for lunch was, man, I see a lot of young kids out here. He's like, I wonder why there isn't somebody speaking about evidence gathering. You know, it's one thing to say I'm a squatcher and go out in the woods and even have night vision goggles, what have you. But what are you bringing back? How are you analyzing that? How are you learning to analyze that? Because it's the learning to analyze data that is the scientific part. That is the integral part of all of this, whether it's UFO, UAPs, whether it's paranormal like you're investigating regularly, or whether it's cryptids. It's the fact of regular analyzable data is what we need.
Exactly. And that's what we do. And there's sort of two camps. There's the thrill seeker camp, which you're just talking about, running around in the woods or going into old abandoned buildings.
Go have fun.
This is great, and running around, but not bringing anything back to the table. Because if we want science, which I think that's the goal of everyone that's serious about this, we want science to take a serious look at it. But if you want to do that, you got to bring something back that's quantifiable, that you can have a theory that you can test and repeat over and over again, and then put it on the table. And that's what we're really trying to do as much as possible. And that's what we put, you know, in the books and even on We Want to Believe. Like, We Want to Believe wasn't the show where everyone was jumping at shadows and screaming and running out of buildings. It was the show where we'd stop and sort of analyze what we're experiencing as best as possible to try to show people what it's really like to do these investigations. But it's not always scary or exciting, but it's a very much a methodical process that you're undertaking.
Science is typically not exciting, Jason. No. As much as I hate to say, I don't want to discourage any kids from becoming like phlebotomists even. You know, or an entomologist or anything like that. But it's not incredibly like wowser scientific exciting most of the time, you know?
No, it's not. I think Neil deGrasse Tyson's one of the few people that can make it interesting to listen to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, but and
not everybody's Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Well, and granted, you know, let's explore this a minute, because as a producer yourself of content, even prior to this show that you're on right now, doing this with We Want to Believe, you have been a producer. You've been on radio. You've been a host. You know what it is to carry a show, carry a conversation when maybe a topic needs to move on, you know, things like that. Now, once again, that's hard to translate things that are scientific into. And this is what I explain to people all the time is, you know, the scientific process itself, because a lot of people complain about, like, for instance, Curse of Oak Island. They're mad because they're 13 seasons in and they haven't found the gold. It's like, never mind right? all the science that they are finding every week that is worth more than the gold in any hole that they will find. That is changing the history of the island, the history of the area, history as we know it. Never mind all of that. We want the gold. And
it's true.
That's an endemic part of the problem, is that we want the gold, Jason. Forget the knowledge that we can glean along the way to the gold. That is the actual gold.
It's funny. I was talking with Paul Bradford, who is, you know, on Ghost Hunters International, and because we interviewed him for our second book, An Investigator's Archive, and we kind of got on the topic, and he kind of nailed it on the head. Like, the only people that really care about the scientific collection of evidence of paranormal activity is other paranormal investigators. The people that are watching these shows, they just want to see the ghost, right?
Yeah.
They want a ghost or a demon or a scare or a cheap thrill,
and
that's really it.
It's what my producer always said. Great story. Where's the juice?
Exactly.
Where's the juice?
What's the hook? What's the lead? You know what I mean? We found this in journalism, doing a crime reporter. What's the most gruesome detail that's maybe not the most important, but that's how you hook the people to read or watch, right?
Like the headline I read about your neighboring area earlier as we came in off Facebook from Conception Bay.
Yes.
Like,
which I'm still laughing about.
You could not set up a better trifecta of a title of facts. Three just straight facts.
That whoever wrote that headline deserves an award.
Absolutely.
Man,
they deserve an yes, exactly. But that's just it. You could have written that headline 28 different ways and not had the zazz and not had the juice that headline had.
Oh, I was laughing for a good 5 minutes. I had to compose myself when you brought me on, because I was just like, wow, I kind of miss journalism sometimes.
And out of live science. It wasn't out of like NBC News or Yahoo or, you know, something like that. Like, out of live science. I was like, wow, that's like Omni putting out a title like that.
Right?
But seriously, it's hard to make science sexy. It's hard to make science sexy.
It is. And we tried, like, if anyone who's watched any of the episodes, we tried to find that kind of balance between the science and the entertainment value.
Yes.
Right? And showing it seriously. So we relied more on kind of our personalities, on finding the interesting histories behind the places that we investigated or the topics that we were covering. And then finding those moments that would stick out, you know, in terms of something paranormal that would interest people. And kind of having those as like little hooks around everything else that we were doing, but still showing the process and how things played out. It's a tightrope act all the time, depending on the episodes and what. We never planned anything. We're a documentary. Yeah. So we go into a location, we know the history, and then things just unraveled as they unraveled. And it was kind of going back afterwards, sometimes after a month, looking at all the footage, going over all the audio evidence we collected, and then seeing how that became kind of a story. Kind of find the one through line that would be a good entertaining story to tell.
Yeah. And as you just said, the evidence you collected, that was a lot of the reason that I wanted to have you on. Because yes, you follow a very scientific process in the way that y'all gather data. And I wanted to cover that and that angle specifically, because, I'm a huge tech freak. I love all my RF equipment that I have. I've got all kinds of wild electronics. I mean, even got a Geiger counter over my shoulder. But knowing how to use that equipment is where it really comes in. I mean, you could go out and buy a red light, green light RF meter all day long. That doesn't mean somebody with a 1982 microwave next door it and making popcorn.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And one of the first things we don't really pay attention to is EMF.
Yeah.
And, you know, the EMF readers, because like you say, someone gets a text on their cell phone, a plane flies over, you know, the phone rings, some guy walks by with a boombox outside. It's affecting that. It is not a sign of paranormal activity, no matter what anyone on the TV shows will tell you.
Yeah.
It's good. We will go in and do a baseline reading to see how much EMF maybe is in a location, because that could be influencing things.
Sure.
But we don't use those as a tool to tell if there's something paranormal happening at all.
Well, and even to see the fact of, oh, sure, there's a spike, but is the spike within norm? You know, yep. Like what is the known quantitative of norm that you can look for where, yes, something will spike and then go away, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Why that spike
happened, right? Taking a moment, going, looking around, making sure something didn't go off. So we don't rely on it as a sense of paranormal activity. One of the big controllable things we do rely on is temperature.
Okay. Get into that for a second.
Yeah, because with temperature, like you can go into a room and you can get a gauge of what the environmental temperature is. And then based on the theory that that the spirits or whatever they are, in order to manifest themselves, they need to draw energy out of the room. And typically then that renders a place colder. And so if you suddenly get a cold spot, as we call it, then you try to figure out if there's a draft causing that or any other kind of airflow that can be contributing. And once you've kind of ruled that out, you know something's going on, as close to something going on as we can get. And we've been in locations that have had activity where we've had a cold spot and we've been able to follow it using temperature readings. And we've even asked it to move across the room left to right. And it's done that in response to our questioning. And then it's moved back. And that room had no airflow. It was a static temperature everywhere around this one cold spot that moved as we commanded it to. And that is something that we can take as a sign that there is something there in the room. We're not going to say it's Casper the Friendly Ghost because we don't know, but something unexplainable was happening that we could measure and that responded to our line of questioning and requests.
Okay.
And so that's how we use temperature.
Yeah. And once again, in a quantifiable way, what kind of equipment are you using typically to measure the temperature in a room like that?
Just like we have these laser pointing thermometers that you can use. We have other devices that are temperature gauges, even like FLIR cameras. You know what I mean?
So
you can
absolutely.
See the cold spot. We've used that. And we've even on an old paddle wheel ship that had paranormal activity reported. We actually got, there was a story about a child having died, like fallen from the ship and died. Like it's dry docked, right? It's now a heritage museum. We picked up, it was about a 4 foot tall cold spot. It was almost, child shaped.
Ooh.
With one of our investigators talking to it, and she was sort of speaking to it and would move, and this cold spot would move with her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was like,
wow.
Can I say that's a ghost or the ghost of this child? I don't know. But it was kid shaped and it moved and it stayed that same shape the whole time. Right.
Well, and
that's pretty wild.
Despite any shape to begin with, an anomalous cold spot following somebody. Yes, precisely. And that's just it. We regularly talk on the show, Jason, about the idea of paranormal and, how like many things in the world, extremism tends to take over. When if you just leave it literally as the defined word paranormal, still impactful and really cool. And you still have the good 3-5% of anomaly there to explore without taking in any. Because, you could have totally said, well, that is a demon stalking her on that haunted ship that's come out of the portal where the captain killed himself.
Right.
All kinds of things. No, all you said is we had an anomalous cold spot in the shape of something that seemed to follow our investigator.
And that's all you can do.
And that's creepy enough. You don't need to take it creepier than a cold spot that's following you.
No, you don't. It's a bit unnerving in its own right. I mean, it's fascinating at the same time. It's like you're very excited to witness this happening. But if you pause and think about it, that is a creepy experience for someone to have.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you now have a single quantifiable to explore. You don't have to explore the source of the energy yet. You don't have to explore whether or not it's a kid, whether or not it's an adult, whether or not it happened where the kid fell and died. All you have to explore is anomalous cold spot following our investigator.
Yeah.
That's it, which really narrows down the scientific process and gets rid of all of the hoo-hoo that would get in the way of that. And I think that that is a big problem in a lot of the paranormal communities and in the way that evidence is garnered and evaluated. Because I think that a lot of the problem, Jason, is that we come to this point of want of validation.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think with that validation, then you get into like the stories that you were mentioning, you know, jokingly earlier, that they want. And I think that's where, and it's tough, and it's kind of, you step on some toes doing this, but people have a belief system, right? Yes. And it can be a spiritual belief system, a religious belief system, a non-religious belief system. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I have my own personal belief systems. I bring none of that to the table when I go on an investigation.
Yeah.
You leave that bias behind and you're just looking at whatever you're getting. And I think, but people want that validation. So they want, if you're, say, Catholic, then you want that experience to validate your Catholicism and vice versa.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, or if you're a total skeptic, you go in ways, try to figure out complete ways to debunk, which we couldn't figure out how to debunk that. And we're going back to this location in a few weeks. We want to see if we can get that cold spot in that spot again. If we get it, you can quantify that again. It's been repeated.
Yeah.
Right? But I think you just got to look at just whatever evidence or facts are happening in that moment. It's like, as a journalist, you just sort of take what you know at the time and you write your story or you do your news story. And then you update it each time there's some new material to add to the story. It's the same thing when investigating the paranormal.
Well, that's
all you can do.
Well, precisely. It's the fact that, and you use the probably my favorite four-letter word in the book, bias.
right?
I'm a little biased to it. But yeah, because yes, with that want of confirmation also comes that confirmation bias and the fact of, because believe me, I am a person of faith, Jason, a person of religious faith, despite any church building standing, what have you. I had my own couple, three very, very, very close personal experiences with that, what I believe to be God. It took me to join the seminary, took me to leave the seminary, all kinds of things. But I am not a religious Catholic, every church Sunday going guy. Yep. I'm not. But that also doesn't color how I look at evidence. And like you're saying, exactly. It shouldn't, because my job is to be the dispassionate skeptic. And
as is mine, even though like even the show's called, the book is like, I want to believe, the shows we want to believe, everyone involved in our investigations, we want to believe in this stuff.
Oh, I
do believe.
It'd be
so much more interesting if it's true.
Ain't no doubt. Like I believe, like I'm sure you've had your experiences amongst your investigations that despite any evidence, you believe.
Oh, for sure. Right.
For sure.
And I'm a very spiritual person too. And I have a whole belief system based around that as well, but I don't bring that to the table.
Exactly.
When I'm investigating.
Exactly.
Even when I have something happen that's a personal experience, I try to step back from that.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And for me, it is the fact of, yes, the dispassionate skepticism. And unfortunately, I think most people, first thing that comes to mind, especially in these communities, is Skeptic Magazine, which, yes, is not proper skepticism.
I know the one you're talking about.
It's one of those that's, it's very biased toward, like, no, none of this is true. And it takes on quite a few. It's Skeptic Magazine takes on quite a few of the topics like what we discuss here, you know, paranormal topics, things like that.
For sure.
But they come at it from a very unskeptic point of view and a very biased point of view, because the proper job of a skeptic is to take in all data and absolutely have your mind changed. You're looking to have your mind changed.
I want to have my mind changed. Yeah. The gentleman, Daniel Loxton, who's written for Skeptical Inquirer, and he and I had a great conversation for this new book I'm writing. And he's the same. He's like that. Like, he's like how we think. Like, he wants to believe in this stuff. So show me. But like in, say, certain topics like lake monsters, he just doesn't think there's anything to it. The evidence to him just leans towards no. But he hasn't signed off on everything that's going on. He wants to be sure. And I think that's how we've got to be. Like, I would love to lean towards all this stuff being true. But I haven't seen quite enough evidence in all departments to believe that everything is like that all these different things are 100% real.
Yeah. Absolutely. And a prime example that we discuss on this show regularly, Jason, is crop circles. That's a big one that a lot of people, whenever I tell them what my show is about, they're like, oh, what about all those bunk crop circles? Like, yeah, what about the ones that were like happening in the 1500s?
Yeah,
like, right. You know what they weren't trying to do in the middle of the Black Plague? Just jack up a whole field of wheat.
Right. And who's going to see it anyway?
Crush it underfoot. You would be burned as a witch, whether you were in league with the devil or not. You destroyed half the town's wheat with your prank. You'd have been burned with all the husks.
There's something to some of those.
When you start looking at things and the fact that, yeah, devil circles have been recorded in England since the 1500s. And yes, even out of modern crop circles, there is an anomalous 3-5%. And even in the world of the paranormal that you're researching, and the spiritual paranormal and the cryptid paranormal, there is this anomalous 3-5% that's one of those. The analogy I make is if I was paying somebody to build me a wall and they went, there's your wall. And I'm like, where's the other 3%? Bah, I don't know. You know,
you can't explain it away.
I don't know a chemist that would just be cool with a 3-5% loss of solution.
Right.
Unexplicably, you know, can't explain how, don't know how, just lost it when I was making the solution. Two things didn't ratio up, came out to 97% of what's left.
So we'll
I don't think you would pass chemistry. I don't think you would pass the chemistry test if you could not account for the 3%.
And that's what we're looking into, is that 3% that you just can't account. Like a lot of the time, a lot of the time you can explain things away in a logical, rational way. And you can, there's lots of, you know, real world.
Yeah.
Normal explanations for it. But there is that small amount, like you say, 3-5, maybe even 10%, that you just can't. And that's the fascinating part. And when you get one of those moments, that's what drives you to keep investigating, because it's just like, you got to know, what is that 3-10%? You know what I mean? That just, you can't explain. Why? Where does it come from? What's it about?
Yeah.
What does it mean to us as a species, even?
Absolutely. I mean, even as an investigative journalist, you want to know. You want to know where that other 3% is. Let's get into some of the cases of that 3-5% that you have come across during your time of investigation, Jason, with the Canadian Paranormal Society.
Well, there's like where to begin. You
know, there's so much. Let's begin with your favorite.
My favorite one?
Let's begin with like the one that really keeps you moving, you know, because there's always one amongst things where it's like, man, we've been there three times and every time there's something crazy. I want to keep going back there. There is something to that. So what is the one that just kind of dogs you in the middle of the night whenever you think about it, Jason?
Well, it's funny because we recently investigated at the Gooding University Inn at Gooding, Idaho, which is hands down probably the most, you know, quote unquote, haunted places I've been in. And it had some very profound things happen there, which we could touch on. But the one that really hooked me and that I keep coming back to happened at Tronchial Sanitarium, which I mentioned earlier in the show, which is one of the first places I investigated. And I went back to that place 3 or 4 times. And one of the times, I went with my friend Donna, who was the psychic that I brought on the first investigation. I'm not sold on psychics 100%, but she's pretty accurate, you know, kind of thing. And we spent the day, we went during the day this time and kind of were exploring and looking into stuff and had some just not much happen, but just a few odd little things. But we decided before we left, we wanted to go into the tunnel system. And now Tronchial, all the buildings at Tronchial are connected by an underground tunnel system. And this was done because it's Canada and in the winter it snows a lot. And so it's easier to move patients and supplies underground than sometimes above ground because of all the snow. And these tunnels go on, it feels like for miles. And it's now they're dark and there's no airflow. And they're creepy just by their very nature that they're these underground tunnels that are always dark. So we explored and we spent quite a bit of time down there. And we went through a door and came out in what would be called the laundry facility. It's like a laundry building where all the laundry was done. And we're like, okay, it's time to go. So we go back to the car, like kind of go up and above ground, or do we want to go back through the tunnels? And so we decided to go back through the tunnels for one final search. And so I turned around and I grabbed the handle of the door. And these doors are the kind where you can kind of just push through them. Like there's no resistance at all. They just kind of flap almost like, you know, batwing doors, but they're big doors. And I'd just gone through the door. I pulled it open and I got about halfway towards me. And then something reefed back on that door with enough force that it slammed shut. And I'm 6'1" and I was about 200 pounds. I was pulled off my feet and I hit the door.
Wow.
And Donna screamed and ran. And I'm not going to lie, I wasn't that far behind her because that was beyond anything I had experienced to that point. I have never had anything happen quite like that since, where I've actually been physically, I mean, I've been sworn at, I've seen objects go off shelves, that kind of thing, but I've never been actually physically moved by something.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a frightening experience when it happens. That is one of the three experiences that I say all the time that I've had my experiences and I can't explain them, but they definitely happened. And that was one for me where I was pushed in the small of my back.
And you know what? You felt it. You've been removed by
It was a hand. Like the number of times I've felt my mother's hand right there to move me out of the way from something and it's frightening when it happens. And like you said, you're not a petite individual, you know, so it's not like it was a gust of wind or something like that that physically moved your body.
No, it was a door. I was pulled it pulled fast enough. You know, you can let go of something sometimes. Like it happened so quick that I couldn't even let go of it until I hit the door. And then I just hit the door and bounced back and said, I'm out. Like, you know what I mean? I'm out of here. And Donna watched it. She was there and saw the whole thing happen.
And did you or anybody else go back to that area to continue investigation or anything like that, Jason?
That was that, man. I didn't investigate for a while after that. Like, I was just like one of those, like, nope, I'm fine for now.
Yeah, yeah. Like, everybody thinks, like, yeah, you know, they went back in the daylight or something like that. Like, no, Jack.
Why? I know what happened.
I got proof enough that I don't need to go back there.
Exactly. And why would you?
And it's interesting because, phenomenologically, you know, just seeing that and the fact of, you know, yes, there are some things that you need no more evidence than that.
And something to do that, I don't like, you know, take as being necessarily friendly. Mm-hmm. It didn't want us there.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't want us there. It said to go. We've wanted to get back to the location since then. It's under new ownership. They just don't let anybody in. And it's kind of a shame because it is falling into disarray and it's probably too dangerous to go into some of those parts of the tunnels anyways.
Yeah.
It would be neat. But my immediate response was, I don't need to go back there anytime soon. Like you know, I quantified up the wazoo on that one.
Well, yeah. But at the same token, that horribly frightening and visceral experience can, like you said, be something that fuels the continuance of work because, yeah, you just had an extreme personal touch with that.
Yeah. And it did. Like once after a while, like taking a little bit of a break and really mulling it over and talking to some people and even going to like people of faith to try to, you know, see what they thought. Just looking at all options. And eventually I did get back to investigating again. You know what I mean? Even on my own. I did it on my own for a number of years, just not really knowing what I was doing. But I kept digging when I could dig. Seeing what I could have happen.
Do you prefer working alone? Do you prefer working in a group?
I like with the group we've got now, especially like with Canadian Paranormal, like myself and Peter, and we have Olivia Aslan and a few other members. I really like working with them. I know I can trust them. I know if someone says, hey, I saw this, I believe them. We all take the very much the same scientific approach as possible. We work together really well. I've been on teams like with Vancouver Paranormal, which is a great team, but it was a very big team and you quite often work with different people. There's a lot of people coming and going.
Yeah.
We're a small group. There's like five of us, six of us tops. We know and trust each other. I like working with them because I know I can trust Peter and Olivier, et cetera, when we're on an investigation. Quite often it's just Peter and I or just Olivier and I. But it depends on the location too, how many people you go with. I mean, we were at that place I mentioned, Gooding. We were with a Western Idaho Paranormal, and they had like 16 of their members there, basically. But it's a huge building. I think you showed some of it. And you could spread out and not run into each other.
Yeah, that was massive.
It's amazing.
Massive, massive spot. And, you know, with that, another question I would have related would be, do you find you get better results by yourself or with a group? And do you think that that is because you have more instrumentation and more eyes on instrumentation in different ways?
Yeah, definitely. You want at least one other, like I've done stuff on my own, but you can trick yourself.
Oh, sure. Sure. Right?
You can totally trick yourself. If you're there with one other person, some, you know, maybe two, you can kind of, did you hear that? Yeah, I heard something. Or no, I didn't. You know what I mean? Like a prime example, Chris, we were at a residential haunting at this woman's home. We'd been there a few times before. The house always delivered. Mm. Something would happen, a lot with electrical. We were down in a basement, and myself and the homeowner were in one room, and then Olivier was on the other side of the door, and Peter was upstairs. And suddenly, like, we're kind of doing our EVP session, and suddenly Olivier jolts. And was just like, did you hear that? And I said, I didn't hear anything. And from upstairs, Peter's like, I heard that. And it was someone going, hello, hello, hello.
Oh, wow.
A disembodied voice saying that. It was behind him. And his audio recorded it. Peter's audio upstairs recorded it. But our audio in that room didn't.
Wow.
So I don't know why, but it shows how even like in different parts of a building, even like so just feet away, you can get a different response.
Oh,
so it's good to have people sort of spread out a little bit as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. And once again, it's not just the response, because yes, different people have different energies. So it would absolutely make sense that a spirit or even another intelligent energy in a space would respond like differently to different people.
Exactly, right? Exactly. Yeah, no, that's a great way to sum it up. Intelligent energy in a space. I dig that.
Yeah. And, well, because I'm not necessarily going to say it's a ghost. I'm not necessarily going to say it's a demon. I'm not going to say it's something. Hey, man, for all we know, it could be literally you on the other side of a dimension.
And there you
we
go, right?
No idea. We got no idea. That is the para of the normal. That's literally the paranormal. And, but the thing is, once again, it's the, having more people makes the team itself an instrument of study.
It does. It does. 100%.
Because somebody could walk in, see something, feel something, everything else, walk in and ask somebody else to just walk in there.
Yeah. And then you can compare.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? And you don't have to tell them beforehand what you feel so that you give them, I guess in a sense that would be almost like a pareidolia, you know,
it would you through power of suggestion, you can influence someone else's experience.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, one prime example I give regularly, I'll play this video real quick. This was recorded in my backyard. Now, if I gave that to you, Jason, I said, I recorded that in my backyard. What would you say?
It's interesting because I've seen something like that myself, and it turned out to be Andromeda.
There you go. That is the planet Sirius.
Okay. See, yeah.
Shot out of focus. Shot with video out of focus in my backyard. Yeah. It was out of focus when I saw it. Like, I didn't take it out of focus and make that happen. It happened to be out of focus and doing because of the brightness.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's making the iris try to flicker and catch it. And that's what's causing the colorations between the flopping colors and everything else. And yeah, so I recorded it.
Yeah.
And then I focused it and checked out Sirius, and it was cool. but for that exact reason, because I could literally take that and post it in 85% of paranormal groups with literally recorded this in my backyard and watch the comments fly.
Yeah.
And watch the pareidolia fly because of my suggestion of, I recorded this in my backyard. Now, you had foresight enough to see the fact that, yes, you yourself had seen something like that in your own backyard.
And did my research, and for us, it was Andromeda.
Through an unfocused telescope, yeah. Or through an right. unfocused pair of binoculars. Exactly.
Yeah.
But it was only because you had been in a similar circumstance. And had I said, you know, looking in this part of the sky, I was looking at this angle, this time of day, everything else, it would have given you a whole nother realm of data. Exactly. And a whole new data set to examine to figure out what that could be. But if I just came out with that and with that mindset, that in and of itself kind of twists the science.
It does. And it's funny. When I was working for Joe Blow Media and running their paranormal network, I get sent stuff all the time. And some guy sent me a picture of a fire and he said he captured a demon in the fire. Well, I looked at it and I saw Batman.
Sweet. You know what I mean?
And I showed it to some other people and they saw this. And I said, went back to him and I said, it's pareidolia, man. You're sort of just seeing kind of what you want to see. You're putting the images together. And he's like, oh, I didn't think you'd be so skeptical and blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like,
Batman?
He was offended by the fact.
Which Batman?
There was the Norm Breyfogle Batman drawn from the 80s.
All right. There you go. Okay. Yeah. Nerdy deep cut. Love it.
Right?
Nerdy deep cut there. But sincerely,
it just
yes.
shows, though.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, there is, I belong to a lot of groups. And unfortunately, because, yes, as a professional audio video engineer and cameraman for, you know, most of what I do now, like I told you before the show, is restoration work. I'm not like out shooting people's stuff. I'm restoring their videos, you know, I'm restoring their audio and video that has been corrupted or something like that. So, it lends to a different set of eyes and filters when I'm looking at information, when I'm looking at a picture, when I'm looking at video, when I'm listening to audio. I hear things that other people don't because they aren't listening for the imperfection.
You get a trained eye and ear for this kind of stuff. When you've done it long, like you say, with your video and audio engineering, and it's the same in investigations. Like you learn to listen for sounds you might not normally listen for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Especially doing an EVP session where everything's like really quiet. And quite often what you do pick up, it's rare when it's like a hello, 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 where you can hear it with, you know, your ear as it's happening. It's usually stuff you hear after the fact and it's very quiet. But you need to train your ears to listen for it. And then you got to go back and, okay, well, what did I hear? And was it like a pin dropping or was it a metal? If you boost the audio, is it something more metallic or is it more like a voice?
Yeah.
And you kind of got to pick apart all these little things you experience. It comes down to really asking, like, it's almost like how deep do you want to go to really get to the facts of something or the truth? Not even the facts, the truth of something. Because you can hear something and say, oh, that was a ghostly voice. I don't need to look anymore.
Yeah. Well, and you know, once again, like you said, how deep are you willing to look at something? And are you willing to go through? Because I think a lot of people forget the mass swath of data that you should be getting on an investigation. Even if you're talking to people, even if you're talking a couple few pieces of equipment, what you're gathering there is a lot. If you're talking about running 3-4 digital recorders for 12 hours long, you know, you got 36 hours of audio to listen to.
And you got to listen to every bit of
like
it.
Not just once, like 3-4 times. So there is a hard, passionate dedication to true, real investigative technique when it comes to analyzing the data that you collect. What kind of data do you guys normally look to collect on, let's start off with a general, somebody called, the Canadian Research Society. They called you guys and said, I have some property that I think may have something going on. I would like somebody to come out and look at it. What kind of data are you looking to gather in that initial visit? And what kind of data are you looking to gather if you come back to location?
First, we'd like to get a history of the place and what's happened there and who's lived there before. Like, have the people that are having these experiences lived there the whole time? Have they, how long, if not, when did they move in? How long has the activity been going on, etc.? And then when we go, we kind of have a meet with them and look around and look at their environment. And that kind of gives you a bit of a feel for the kind of people they are, and ask some sort of questions. And the way that they'll kind of explain what's going on to you will kind of tell you a lot too, because sometimes they'll explain stuff that's very much of the TV model. And so you kind of wonder, sure. Some people we go to, they have legitimate something going on in their house that they can't explain and they want to know what it is. Other people kind of want to have a paranormal experience. That, you know, I've been into people's houses where I've looked around and they've got, like, you know, every season of Ghost Hunters on their DVD shelf. They've got, you know, posters up. They've got, like, vast horror movie collection. You kind of just got to be a little bit careful.
Nobody
in that
will
sense, because they kind of want
believe
something to
my
happen.
Experience now.
Yeah, right? Like, they want they want us to prove that their place is 100% haunted with full of demons.
Yeah.
And then we kind of do, like, an initial investigation. Quite often we will ask the people to leave. And we'll stay in their house for even just for a couple hours to get a base reading. We primarily just stick with EVP sessions. We use a spirit box, which we kind of with a noise gate added because they're very noisy devices. And then we'll run cameras. And that's we keep it pretty simple with the first one. And then we see if we get anything that kind of matches what we've been told.
Okay.
Or that sticks with the history. And then we bring it back to the homeowner or the business owner, etc. And see what they think. And then based on that, we either investigate again or we don't. Sometimes people don't want you to come back because you haven't validated what they wanted or they feel satisfied with what they've got. But it's really great when we can go back multiple times. We've got a few places we go to many times because then you can kind of test your theories about a place over and over again. And we've got done some residentials. We've been able to go back 5-6 times. We've got like some historic sites we visit on a regular basis. And that's really great because then you can take from each investigation, you can build on your body of data to try to then see how much, I guess, just prove or disprove your findings from the previous time.
Yeah.
And you can kind of keep doing this, I think, to infinity because where do you stop?
Yeah. Right? Well, And I guess that once again is what would be the part of the second part of that question, which is what spurs the second visit?
It's quite often like if we think there's enough sort of activity going on to warrant a second visit, we'll ask to come back. But it's usually then left definitely up to like the homeowner, or the business owner, or the site owner, if we do or don't. And it's great when they say yes. So then we go back for a second time, and then we sort of again bring more evidence back.
What's your check? What is your like getting the car inspected? Here's the 5-point checklist. What are the you know, what are the 5 things that, like, whenever you go in as a team, like, you all get together outside? Because of course you aren't necessarily together in the house while you're doing an investigation, correct? All the team in the same room at the same time.
Or you'll do different floors. It depends on the size, because you don't want, sometimes we do stick together because in some houses they're not big enough. And if you're doing an EVP session one place, you can actually be heard because some of our equipment is so sensitive.
Oh yeah.
So you don't want to taint that data that they're collecting. So we sometimes stick together, but we go off for a half hour, for an hour in different spots. And then we meet again, talk a bit. Then we go off again and switch locations. Okay. And then you kind of compare, well, like, because sometimes one team gets something, the other team doesn't, right? And you kind of go, all right. And then you get enough data. It's like, okay, we've definitely got, like, you know, a few really solid EVPs here. We'll go back and look at some of the video and see if we picked anything up. And if it's compelling enough, if you say no, that the home used to be owned by someone named Dan, and when you're asking, you know, could someone here please identify themselves? And you get the name Dan. Oh, well, that's something, right? And so that kind of, you take that back then to the current owner and say, yeah, someone named Dan, you know, we picked that up and they used to own here. What do you think? And they'll go, this is great. Come back and let's try it again.
Yeah. Yeah. You're looking for some basis of confirmation from different parts of the team.
Yes.
Within the team itself, where it's like, yes, I got an anomalous reading. Yes, I got an anomalous reading too. In the same location, not necessarily like I got one in the garage. I got one upstairs. Cool. Let's come back.
You can now go upstairs and I'll go in the garage. We each get something in those. But now that means something, because otherwise it could just be something outside or a block away or a car.
Yeah, absolutely.
Firing, or whatever.
Hey, right? The kid next door could be a ham freak, you know, and over there, like using his ham radio, talking to people in Turkmenistan. Who knows?
Right. Anything is possible.
Hopefully you saw the antenna as you approached the house. However,
we usually look for that kind of thing. Yes, right.
However,
and then we're aware that could be playing into what people are experiencing.
Things like that fully happen. And we have a large community of targeted individuals that listen to this show, Jason. And that's one reason why I bring it up, is because even whenever I go to their property, before I ever bring out RF Analyzer 1, before any of that ever comes out and we start looking for satellite signals or anything like that, I bring out Gauss meters. Let's look for any strange, just magnetic signatures that may be in the house, something like that. You may be living over an ore deposit, something like that. I bring out
exactly right.
Geiger counters, because you may have a fault line underneath your place that you don't quite know about.
And that will be affecting your experience.
Gamma radiation leaking through your floor.
Exactly.
Carbon monoxide detectors, all that kind of stuff. Natural gas leak detectors. Once I get rid of the norm that we can explain, now we'll go for the para.
Exactly. And Peter's a plumber by trade.
Yeah.
Right? And buildings, so he knows to look for all that stuff in buildings. You know what I mean? And we do that. I even, if it's out, I don't snoop too much. But if I see sort of pill bottles out on a counter, take a quick look if people are on any. You know what I mean? The medication can affect what people are experiencing, right?
Absolutely.
Like, there's so much.
My God, my mother saw little children outside of her third floor hospital window. Ambien.
Right?
That'll get you, dude. It's like, there are no little children out there.
Nope. 3 floors up. There's no way.
Or maybe there were.
That's a whole different conversation.
That's the funny thing, is that the more conversations I have, the more people I talk to, especially the one thing I bring up regularly is remote viewing. The remote viewing conference, man, and hearing the concept of, because I heard Hal Putoff at the remote viewing conference tell the same story about a UFO experiencer that Kathleen Martin told on this show about how they went to, they were near the craft, they felt it vibrating, and they felt themselves vibrating, and when they touched the craft, they passed through it.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, number one, I loved the fact that Hal Putoff kind of like used The Flash as a reference. It's like, it's in The Flash comics, you know.
He totally could do that. He could vibrate through things. He's moving so fast, right?
Absolutely. But it sets up the whole realm of, we may have numerous realms right next to us vibrationally. What we physically see of the spectrum is like, it's a sesame seed on the bun of the hamburger, dude.
Well, doing research for our book on near-death experiences, man, that changed my perception on so many things.
Yeah.
Like with people talking about how you can vibrationally shift into a past life even, or to that space between lives. Like, it's just like, wow. And that was like was like a good 8 to 10 months to write that book, write and research that book. And that changed my thought process on so much.
Yeah.
But I still try not to bring that in on an average investigation, because that's in a realm. I don't like explaining an unknown with another unknown.
Yes. Yes. You can.
You know what I mean?
You can't.
I don't believe these other things can happen, but I can't just go in and say, yeah, it's a past life. It's affecting you now. Cause that's not scientific.
Yeah.
And that'll never hold up.
Past life intruding on present time.
That's, right?
as Egon would say.
I know, from Ghostbusters.
but that's just it. You can't do that. As our good friend Stephen Myers likes to say, correlation is not evidence.
No, it's not.
You know, just because something correlates to something else does not mean that that is the evidentiary fact. And if you want it to be that way, folks, feel free to let it apply that way next time you're in court. I mean, seriously, like, no, you should want the same evidentiary standard that you want when people are trying to bring something against you in court. Like, that evidence better be huge. Right? Yeah, precisely. That is what we should be trying to do. And it's good to see that there are people like you guys out there that take it as seriously as this, that do not just leave it to the fluff, you know, because there's an opportunity to a lot of fluff, man. Y'all are out there. You're making a show as well, but that doesn't mean that it has to be fluff.
And that's, we've tried very hard to stay away from that.
I think you've done well.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, Chris.
Let everybody know, actually, where they can go to check out the show. I've got the IMDb up and stuff like that, but where can they go to actively see it?
The show is still actually running up on the Paranormal Network on YouTube, which was run by Joe Blow Media Incorporated. It's now a defunct channel, but the episodes are still up there.
Okay.
We're currently in production on some new episodes and looking for a new home, which we might be getting close on. Okay. You can find a lot of our stuff on Facebook still with the Canadian Paranormal Society. And of course, you know, CanadianParanormalSociety.ca. And I like to be pretty active, like on Instagram and Facebook as Jason Hewlett. On Instagram, it's the official Jason Hewlett, I think I called myself. I don't know. I can't remember. Someone else had taken Jason Hewlett. So
yes, he's a comedian.
He is. Yes. We get confused quite a bit, which is kind of interesting. but yeah, we're up on all the social media as well. And the books you can find through Beyond the Fray Publishing or on Amazon.
Fantastic. And of course, you can always find all of our guest books right there on curiousrealm.com/store, folks. Simply click the picture. It'll take you right there to Amazon to be able to purchase their stuff. Man, Jason, I would love to have you on again and again and again, man. This has been such a great conversation. I am so happy to hear. I know that there are a lot of paranormal groups out there. I know that there are a lot of people who want to get into the field of paranormal. I don't think a lot of people who want to get into the world of research fully understand what research is. And it goes back to, like you were as an investigative journalist, you know.
Yeah.
There are very few people, prime example, who enjoy writing a research paper. There's a prime example of how to put it, folks. If you enjoyed going to the library and just pouring through microfiches and finding things and digging stuff up and annotating it,
might be a good paranormal investigator.
You might be a good paranormal investigator. You may really love this. You know, if you like going out on the boat, way out to the water and coming back and catching nothing over and over and over and over and working your butt off, you might be a good paranormal investigator.
Exactly. Because you're going to get nothing nine out of 10 times.
Well, yeah. The idea of literally going fishing. It's not called catching.
No, it's fishing.
it's called fishing
for evidence,
it's
called man. Fishing,
you know? But that's just it. It takes a lot of work to, learn to garner the proper evidence, learn to see what evidence actually is and learn what to look for. Because you could be getting small, tiny little readings, things like that, that you're letting pass by that could actively be something.
It could, especially if you're just way too focused on the thrill or the scare that you want to get, right? And there's so many YouTube channels where that's all it's about. Mm. You know, they just want to make a buck throwing something potentially scary, but probably not real up there. If you want to be a paranormal investigator, you got to go into it with the right mindset and the right intention.
With that being said, as we get ready to let you go, Jason, what is your best advice that you can give not only to the individual that wants to possibly get their property, their family, anything like that investigated, that may have a troubled issue, a troubled property? And what is your best advice that you can give to a individual or group that is wanting to go out there and do what you do professionally, not, you know, just weekend warrior go out and break into an old hospital and hang out with a palm quarter, you know?
There's lots of those. That's
there's
for sure.
Plenty of them and too many. And that is not what I espouse. Don't do that and use my name or be wearing my merch is all I can say.
Exactly.
Go through the proper channels. There are ways to do it. So
there are. And I think advice. For the people wanting to be an investigator, I think the big thing is find someone who's done it for a long time and, you know, beg them, plead them to go along with them to see what they do. Because that's how you prevent yourself from being a thrill seeker.
Yeah.
You know, I was lucky to have met Peter and his team, and Peter's been doing it for like 3 decades all over the world. Learned so much working with him. And so you learn from working with people who really know what they're doing, who take it seriously. That's my advice, is to find the people that are like that. Yeah. And there are people out there. You can find them. You just got to do a little bit of looking.
Easier and easier these days than what it used to be.
Have what you think is a haunting going on in your house, you want help, there are lots of groups out there. The biggest telltale that they're full of crap is they expect you to pay them.
Yep.
Us in the field are doing this because for the passion and love of it and for wanting it to be taken seriously and move the science forward. No serious paranormal investigator will charge you money. Same with a psychic. That's sort of my biggest bit. So if you find a group that's willing to come, you know, look at their website, see how long they've been around for. They're well established for a long time. They're not wanting to bill you anything. Allow them to come in and have that initial visit.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Precisely. And if they're contacting you, be wary of that.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, do your research into them. Like, we have reached out to some people, but only because it's been recommended that we should. By someone. So there's always that for a warning. But yeah, if there's kind of a bunch of guys in black show up on your front steps and just say, hey, man, we want to investigate your house, I'd be a little bit leery.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Don't let anybody creep around in your basement, things like that.
No.
And that's just it. It really is on both sides of the coin, really, an open mind and a wary eye situation. You know, whether you're talking about looking at evidence, or whether you're talking about how to approach going and doing an investigation.
Exactly.
Once again, there are proper ways to do things. There are ways to go about doing it. Contact your local officials, contact your local city hall, stuff like that. You would be surprised how helpful some of those places are if you simply call them and ask them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Find who's the board of directors for this. If it's a historical site or society, find who's on the board of directors, talk to them, come up with a pitch or proposal.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Jason, thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it. Before we let you go one last time, let everybody know where they can go to get a hold of the Canadian Paranormal Society, where they can go to contact you if they have a property that needs to be looked at, or if they are near you and want to get involved.
Yeah, you can find us on Facebook at the Canadian Paranormal Society. And of course, you can find us at CanadianParanormalSociety.ca. There's a contact form right on there where you can reach out to us, and myself or Peter will get back to you.
Fantastic. Please do come back on the show. I would love to have you back on to talk about cryptid research, to talk about your new book that is coming out. Everything else, man. Thank you so much for taking the time, coming on, talking with the audience tonight and sharing everything about I Want to Believe. Go out there and get your copy, folks. It is fantastic. Great reading. I'm looking forward to finishing this on my plane ride along with Before Roswell, another upcoming guest. So thank you so much for the time tonight, Jason.
Thanks so much for having me on. Yeah, I'll come back anytime, Chris.
All right. Well, I'll be reaching out with links, everything else. You take care.
You as well.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Man, incredible conversation there, folks. Make sure to stop on by and check out the Canadian Paranormal Society. CanadianParanormalSociety.ca is the website. You can also find them on Facebook. Make sure to stop on by and check out the We Want to Believe group as well. And stop on by and check out that show on Canadian television. While you are on the interwebs, checking everything out, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. That is where you can find everything Curious Realm, all of our episodes. That is where you can find our newly revamped store with all of the books from our guests, including Jason and Machiel, even Dr. Robert Duncan, who we will be having on here in a couple weeks. We have some fantastic guests coming up. So speaking of guests coming up, right after these messages, folks, we will be coming back with our good friend and guest, Daniel Duke, fellow Texan, talking about his life as a descendant of Jesse James, how his research into his descendancy to descendant relative being a descendant of Jesse James with his mother got him followed by authorities. Really, really interesting story there, as well as the possibility of Jesse James burying treasure right here in Texas, coming up after these messages. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spigeric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7%. Off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies. Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to our sponsors, especially Dr. Kimberly McGeorge from The Secret of Everything. SecretToEverything.com is her website. She is your source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness expansion exercises. Stop on by. SecretOfEverything.com is her website. We will be getting her on soon to talk about updates and amazing projects that she has been working on. While you are online checking that out, of course, make sure to stop on by the Curious Realm store. That is where you can find the books of our guest for this segment, the amazing Ken Gerhart. Welcome back to the show, Ken. How are you doing?
Hey, Christopher. I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking. It's always good to speak to you, my friend.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We recently saw each other at the, that was the Texas Legends and Monsters Conference. And I won a chupacabra bone from one of your investigations. We will be getting into that in just a minute, but I wanted to kind of touchstone before we went into that with the recent cattle mutilations in Madison County here in Texas. I was actively sent a photo from a listener. Pardon the graphicness, folks. That is a mutilated cow. These things have been going on since at least the late 70s that I know of. I've heard about them since I was a kid in the 80s. Linda Moulton Howe kind of started her career with this, and it's pretty wild to see it popping. It's never really left the radar necessarily, but cases certainly wane and come back, things like that. What do you make of the whole recent mutilations here in Texas, Ken?
Well, admittedly, Christopher, I've investigated some livestock mutilations with regard to certain cryptids, but typically not cattle. It's always been goats or smaller animals. You got to imagine take something sizable to to deal with a cattle. But you're right. The phenomenon, to my knowledge, goes back at least to the 70s. It started kind of up in Colorado and parts of the western U.S., and then it kind of, gravitated around wherever you had kind of ranch land and stuff. I will add that a colleague of ours, Rob O'Brien, has written the definitive book on livestock mutilations. It's literally as thick as a friggin' encyclopedia or a phone book.
Wow.
It's really, really, I got to see it last year. It's really impressive. He's really done a deep dive. And so I think, from my perspective, a lot of these types of phenomenon are cases of what we'll refer to as composite identity, meaning that I think there's probably different things going on here. There may in fact be some anomalous thing going on here. Mm-hmm. You see some of the photos that you see sometimes, it just doesn't look like the work of a natural predator. And I can tell you, I'm familiar with the work of like mountain lions and wild dogs and different things. And this looks surgical. I mean, it doesn't look like this is not a lot of, bite marks or ripped up hair or anything like that. I guess, the popular theory for years has been aliens, which, who knows? I mean, it's anything's possible.
As likely as anything else.
Right. Of course, satanic cults was kind of a popular suggestion back in the day. And, maybe we don't have to be overly dramatic by characterizing them as satanic cults. They may just be, cults? Teenagers and weirdos and people that just sacrificing animals. I guess animal sacrifice is obviously a tenet for many religions around the world. So yeah. I don't mean to be disparaging of anyone's religious belief, although I don't think it's necessary to sacrifice an animal per se. I'm an animal lover. So I think there's probably a lot of different variables or factors going on here. Now, you kind of clued me into these recent killings, so I haven't had a lot of time to look into these. But I'm trying to think of where Madison County is located. Is that – or is that Northeast Texas, or is that
– yes.
I'm trying to equate it to something
old
regional.
San Antonio Road out near Madisonville, so –
oh, okay. Yeah, it's kind of near College Station. Yeah. I'm seeing it. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I'm trying to think if there is a history of cattle mutilations in that area. Now, I can give you a couple of stories. One would be in terms of, just accounts. That particular area, that region, is known to be a major corridor of our friend Bigfoot or Sasquatch, mm-hmm. the Texas Bigfoot. So people that want to sort of dance around that particular conspiracy, although I don't see any reason why a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch
that's a big critter for a Sasquatch. I mean, not saying that a Sasquatch ain't huge and brutal, and hey, like a chimpanzee has five times the strength of a human being.
You're right, but I mean, to your point,
that's a big critter to take down for a single animal, and then just to eat the jowl.
And there aren't a lot of accounts of Sasquatches killing cattle, not that I'm familiar with. Yeah, that's pretty rare. Now, to your point, I think you made a great point just now. Let's eliminate, again, different types of known predators. Now, there's a misconception about animals like mountain lions and bears that they are, they are known to take larger animals like elk and things like that.
Oh, but absolutely.
Generally speaking, most predatory animals are always looking for the easiest meal. And so that's why the majority of the diet of those types of animals is really just small things like rabbits and rats, rodents, birds, things like that, because no predator wants to risk getting injured. Even if it's successful in its kill, if a predator sustains a major injury, that's kind of all she wrote. So,
well, in most things, especially at not that we don't have big cats here in America, but most of them, unless you're talking bobcats, something like that, are not necessarily the actively stalk and chase down the prey, but much more of the pounce from on top.
Right.
Surprise hunter, not like a Serengeti cheetah or group of lions that chase down gazelles.
That's a good point. And can you put that picture up again?
Absolutely.
Looks like is that the lower mandible? Or are we looking at the bottom of the head?
You're looking pretty much, this is the side of the head. If you look right here, you've got an ear, an eye socket, and then you've got the top snout and then the bottom jowl right there. So it kind of looks as though the entire basically side of the face, like the entire top and bottom mandible skin, has been removed.
Now, in the article, do they mention any obvious cause of death for this cow? Perhaps it was killed before it was mutilated, or is that just conjecture at this point?
Just conjecture at this point, as far as I know.
Okay, so six-year longhorn cow. Yeah, that's a weird one, man. I really don't know. I mean, like I said, I wouldn't jump right to the alien card as much as people like to, because I don't.
Tongue was also completely removed from the body with no blood spilt.
Oh, that's interesting. The tongue was removed. People like to eat tongues, don't they, Christopher?
Absolutely. I'm not going to lie. Tongue taco's delicious, man. Okay, I'm from Austin, the town of tacos.
Right.
I will tear up a lengua taco.
Yeah, I'm with you, man. Lengua's okay. I don't know. I would say, this – is this one of those anomalous cases? Now, it'll be interesting to see if there are more or similar killings that kind of surface around that area. Then if once we start developing a potential pattern or, more data, then I think we could definitely be looking at something worth pursuing. But I know not. Like I said, it's definitively not, like you said, doesn't look like a big cat, doesn't look like wild dogs. Bear. There are no bear native to that part of Texas. Sasquatch or Bigfoot. Now, here's interesting. I just thought of this.
Sure.
This is why you keep me on the show for extended periods of time. There is a type of Sasquatch, a Bigfoot, from Central America, and I believe we're talking about Honduras. No, wait. Costa Rica? Well, anyways, where the Sasquatches are known as the Arranca Lengua, or tongue ripper, because of their purported habit of ripping the tongues out of cattle. Isn't that interesting? Similarly, there is a similar legend regarding, if you've heard of the Mapinguari, which is the kind of the Brazilian version of Bigfoot, it has also been alleged to rip the tongues out of cattle. So I don't think that would explain the surgical sort of, you know, situation that we're seeing there with the face being kind of shaved off, but with the tongue being ripped out, I mean, you know, for those Bigfoot fans out there that are listening, that, you know, you could at least, you know, speculate about something like that.
That is really interesting to know. I never realized. I mean, I of course knew that there were tales of Sasquatch type creatures, things like that, but I never knew that there was one that specifically was a tongue lover,
a tongue ripper. Yeah. Central and South America. Now,
wow.
You could certainly, diving into Bigfoot lore, you can find all kinds of behaviors that are attributed to Sasquatches. So, I mean, this is just like one of many things that they're said to do,
sure.
Predation patterns or behaviors and different things. But, I don't know, man. It's a fascinating mystery for sure.
It is definitely one I've contacted. Thank you very much to, of course, listener James Dancer out there for the amazing picture. He is trying to contact the rancher that sent it to him to see if they would be willing to come on the show. And of course I'm going to be following the story, like crazy, with it being right here in our backyard. Just a little bit down the road though, here in the last week was also a chupacabra story coming out of Alabama. Alabama Fish and Freshwater Fisheries Division identifies strange looking chupacabra. And I wanted to kind of chat with you about this one because we'll, of course, be talking about the chupacabra bone that I won in the auction from one of your investigations. But this is, I think, probably what most people who say, like, I've seen a chupacabra in Texas. This is, I think, probably what most people have come across. Not that there have not been some strange sightings, things like that. But let's start getting into chupacabra in Texas a little bit, Ken, and your investigations into it.
Let's go back a little bit, Christopher, and talk about the origin of the name chupacabra in Texas, because a lot of people aren't familiar with how this whole thing unfolded. Most people are probably, of course, familiar with the Puerto Rican chupacabra, which burst onto the scene in 1995. On the island nation of Puerto Rico, there was a series of mysterious livestock killings, not cattle, but small animals like goats, rabbits, things like that. And they were said to be exsanguinated. That is, the carcasses of these livestock animals were completely devoid of blood. And it was also alleged that there were telltale puncture wounds that were left behind in the throat area. So sounds like a vampire, basically, right, if you believe in those types of things.
Yeah.
And then shortly thereafter, there were alleged sightings, and it kind of made worldwide news because in that time, in 1995, as you know, Christopher, there was this brand new thing called the Internet, and they were looking for basically material, different websites, and I think it was Princeton University that actually put up the first chupacabra website, which may still be up to this day. And then the original images of the reptilian chupacabra from Puerto Rico with the big eyes, the spikes going down its back, the forked tongue and all that was widely disseminated. Now, fast forward, and then I should say shortly thereafter, there were also chupacabra accounts coming out of Mexico, Nicaragua, Chile, other parts of Latin America. Fast forward to 2004. There was just south of San Antonio here where I live in a little town called Elmendorf. There was a guy named Devin McAnally who I've interviewed. He was a chicken farmer, and he something was killing his chickens in mass numbers, and he knew it wasn't a bobcat or a mountain lion or a raccoon or anything, coyote, anything he was used to, because these chickens were not being eaten or dragged away. They were basically just being killed. And again, according to him, it seemed like the bodies were bloodless. Around that same time, Devin started seeing this weird animal on his property, which looks just like the photograph you just kind of put up there. It was a four-legged animal, kind of bluish gray skin, mostly hairless, long fangs, just really weird looking. He managed to shoot it, took a picture of it, buried it, and he started showing the photo around to his neighbors and saying, "Do you know what this is, this animal that was killing my chickens?" And they said, "No, that's weird. We don't know what it looks like, a big rat or who knows." So he took a photo down to the local market, which is called De Leon's Meat Market, where a lot of the old timers from Mexico would frequent to buy things like lengua, I would imagine. And some old timers came in and saw the photo that he had posted, and they said, "Oh, es a chupacabra. We have those in Mexico." And so that is the very first time, to my knowledge, that the name chupacabra was uttered in the state of Texas, April of 2004. Since that time, there have been many of these animals. Now, we should point out that the animal that Devin killed was finally exhumed. The remains were exhumed. There was a DNA test that was overseen by none other than Whitley Strieber, the author of Communion, who's from San Antonio and took an interest in the case. The bones were taken to my San Antonio Zoo, where they were examined by a mammal curator named John Gramieri, who I've interviewed. And he said that, yeah, as soon as he saw the skull, he said, "This is a dog, but it has some weird features in its teeth and the articulation of its jaw." The DNA test that Whitley Strieber funded, I think it was Cal Berkeley, came back as a dog, domestic dog or canid. So from the very get-go, we knew that these Texas chupacabras were canids. And this has been kind of supported by multiple DNA tests through the years. I've examined the remains of at least a half dozen of these things. They are definitively canids, but they do have some weird features. Now, a lot of people will say that they are – oh, yeah, we'll get to that one here in a minute. A lot of people will say that – the name chupacabra, you know, it at this point, it really has become a little bit more of a clickbait situation where I think, like, you know, throw the name chupacabra paranormal up and is
I would tend to agree with you. It is definitely a buzzword.
Yeah. It's a cool sounding word. Yeah. So, but in terms of, the people that want to dispel all of these as merely quote unquote mangy coyotes, I think that's a little bit, in my opinion, it's a little bit of a disservice, and I'll tell you why. Many ranchers and people in Texas have seen mangy coyotes. Mm-hmm. Mange, of course, sarcoptic mange, Sarcoptes scabii, I think is the Latin. It's a little mite that gets in the fur of different animals like dogs, coyotes. They scratch. The hair falls out, they chew, they scratch. Look at this animal. Look how uniformly its hair is gone.
Yeah.
Except for a little tuft or a mohawk right there on the back of the neck. I've seen that on other specimens too. Furthermore, the skin does look kind of necrotic and kind of, I don't know, tough, leathery. But you don't see, or I don't see a lot of like scabs or bloody patches or anything that would indicate it was scratching or chewing, right? Mm-hmm. Also, many of these animals that I've examined have had unusual dentition, weird teeth, disproportionate limbs, gross on their bodies. So there seem to be, at least in my opinion, there are other things going on here with these animals. They are canids. They're dogs.
Sure.
Do they drink blood? That would be the ultimate definition of chupacabra, right? Is it just sucking the blood of fawns?
Sure.
That's been alleged by a couple of ranchers that I've spoken to that have killed these animals or found these animals dead, but there's no scientific evidence for that. Now let's talk about the one that you have the bone for. That is known as the Rootersville chupacabra. This was an animal that was road killed near Rootersville, Texas, which is up near Fayetteville. And I was investigating a property starting in 2009 where there were a lot of these animals running around. People were seeing them all the time, and a lot of the neighbors were seeing them. Just up the road is Rootersville. One of these strange-looking canids, dogs, had been road-killed, and it was so weird-looking, Christopher, that there were a bunch of cars pulled over by the side of the road, and people were kind of standing around gawking at this thing, like, what the heck is this? Hmm. Well, fortunately, someone had the wherewithal to throw the thing in the back of his pickup truck, and he got it to a gentleman named Harvey Hayek, who's the guy who owns the property where I'd been doing investigations. And Harvey called me up one day and said, "Hey, Ken, I got a body, a carcass in one of these chupacabra things. Do you want it?" I said, "Sure, I'll be right there." It's 2.5 hour drive from San Antonio, but I headed out there. Unfortunately, he had put it in a cooler full of ice, Christopher. But as you know, a cooler full of ice sitting out in the Texas sun for a couple of days or a day or so.
Half a day, man.
Yeah. So by the time I got there, this thing was rank. It was rotting.
More than waterlogged.
Smelling. It was just water, tepid. Mm. So I dumped out the water. I think I put it back, packed it back in ice and put it in a cooler. And at that time, I was driving a Chevy Equinox, which, you know, the thing really, the smell permeated my whole.
I was going to say, you were intimately near.
It was pretty bad. Yeah. I called a friend of mine on the way to San Antonio, a police officer who I knew was a pretty resourceful guy, and I asked him if he knew anyone that could loan me a small cooler, you know, which I guess for whatever reason I ended up probably to his benefit or his whoever's it belonged to. I didn't borrow that cooler because I might have contaminated, but I brought this thing back to San Antonio with me. I kept it in this cooler full of ice, packed on my patio and in my apartment complex. And I'm sure, Christopher, that some of my neighbors thought I was a serial killer there for at least for a couple of days there.
Yeah.
I called around to different taxidermists. This is my first thought was, wow, I could get this thing mounted. That would be, you know, very useful. Hmm. But none of the taxidermists I called wanted to touch it. They said it sounded like it was too far gone, et cetera, et cetera. So I took it over. I had a friend who owns a house here in San Antonio. Good friend. Obviously, you'd have to be a good friend to let you do this. I said, "Can I bury this thing in your backyard? But first, I'm going to examine it." He was like, "Sure." So I brought it over, dumped it out on a tarp, took a lot of photos and measurements. It did appear, obviously, to be a canid. Its skin was intact. It was kind of a not so much bluish gray, but maybe more of a dark brown color. But it was almost completely hairless. It had a strange overbite. Its upper mandible was really extended beyond its lower, and its limbs were disproportionate. Its front limbs seemed to be much shorter than its rear limbs, which is kind of weird. So it had some strange genetic anomalies. Mm. So I buried it in his yard, and this is a funny story. I don't know if I told this at the conference or not, but I think I did. So right as we're burying this thing in his backyard, this dog-like animal, his neighbor, who he had been having problems with because his neighbor had a loud barking dog, stuck his head over the fence and goes, "Hey, have you guys seen my dog? It got out of my backyard." And of course, here we are with like both of us with like shovels in hand and this carcass in a tarp. And Really? We'll keep an eye open for it.
Nope.
I buried it in his yard for a year. And then in 2013, I was contacted by National Geographic. They were doing a documentary or a special, a TV show on chupacabras. And I said, "Hey, I've got an idea. Why don't you send your crew over and I will exhume the carcass of this thing and we'll see where it's at in terms of decomposition and maybe we can, you know, get the bones or whatever."
Yeah.
I don't know if you want me to, this is kind of a sidebar here, but it's a really ridiculous story in terms of the silliest TV show that I've ever worked for. So it was a show called Monster Project. I don't recommend that anyone look it up. I was told initially that it was going to be very scientific, you know, it was actually Nat Geo Wild. So a subsidiary of National Geographic. It's going to be very scientific, blah, blah, blah. the first day I show up at, or I show up at the property that morning at 11, we had scheduled a meetup time for 11 o'clock in the morning to start filming. And, I show up at 11 o'clock and they're not there. The crew's not there. Well, you know, working in television like Christopher, that's not, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So I call it, I call up the producer. I said, "Hey, I'm here at the location. You guys coming?" And the producer responded, "Oh, you're there." And I was like, yeah, 11 o'clock, what we scheduled. I'm probably coming off as a little bit intolerant here, but you know, I'm an OCD guy. So it's
made an appointment. I mean,
yeah,
it's
a TV shoot. So anyways, they finally showed up. They gave me a whole song and dance about how they were on a tight budget. So they, you know, they weren't going to be able to pay us a lot or whatever, but somehow strangely they had like 3 15 passenger rental vans full of crew, and they did buy us some pizzas. I guess we should be thankful for that. But I did. We dug the thing up, and oh god, it still stunk to holy hell, man. When I undid that tarp, and of course, maybe a little bit too graphic here, but when you bury something in the ground for a year, it doesn't necessarily decompose that fast. So it was still kind of slimy and gross, and I'll never forget the look of the some of the female producers who were particularly offended. We were kind of like, you know, they're probably standing about 4 yards away, kneeling down and probably retching. But I did manage to – this time I kept the bones, and then, of course, I cleaned them and bleached them and all the things that you're supposed to do with an animal carcass. And so that's what you got there, is a rib from that so-called Rootersville Chupacabra is featured on Nat Geo Wild. And, it's a canid. We had a DNA test done. I should say that. They did spring for a DNA test on a tissue sample, and it came back as a domestic dog. Canis familiaris. So it was like a feral dog, basically. But Christopher, it had these weird – there were things – you know, it wasn't just a mangy dog. There was something else going on in terms of other physical abnormalities. Now, I'm going the long way around the barn here, but – by the way, I finally saw one of these animals alive in 2018 outside of Corsicana, Texas, in the middle of the night. So they're not as rare. People still send me photos from time to time, but they're out there.
Yeah.
I think the greatest mystery is, you know, even if we can't fully explain why they look like this, which in my mind they're not just mangy. I think there's more going on here.
Yeah, I mean, even this one from Alabama, whenever you look at it, like I've seen mange on animals before, things like that, but there is a distinct striation pattern to what looks to be this dog's undercoating, coloration, things like that. Like that is once again, it would be a pretty distinct scratching pattern for it to be caused by mange.
You would expect that, and maybe more patches of hair on its body.
Yeah.
I think there's, for my money, I think there's a genetic component at work here. I think that their mange could be a factor. Absolutely. Sure. But I think that these animals are also, you know, I don't want to get melodramatic, but in terms of mutation, one thing that I've noticed is by plotting all of the, or most of the sightings that I'm familiar with of these animals in Texas. And by the way, most cryptozoologists now refer to these as the Texas blue dogs, which sounds like a football team or something, but it's actually, it is an official name for this version of the chupacabra. I noticed that most of the sightings of these animals have occurred around coal burning power plants, which fortunately are becoming less prevalent. And a lot of them are shutting down now. But back in that time, in the early 2000s, there were still several coal-burning power plants in Texas. And in fact, from Harvey Hayek's property, close to where the Rootersville Chupacabra was found, you can clearly see the smoke billowing out of a big coal-burning power plant down the road there. If I can get on my soapbox for a moment.
Please.
Coal-burning power plants emit tons of lead, mercury, sulfur dioxide, all kinds of horrible stuff into the atmosphere, and it gets into the air, probably gets into the water system. And so sometimes when we have these pollution incidents, we have things that are known as indicator species. Oftentimes it's amphibians, you know.
Sure.
Some of your folks may remember the deformed frogs that turned up in Minnesota years ago that had like extra legs and all kinds of weird. So I think that, you know, we could be looking at basically pollution or environmental factors here in terms of pollutants and things getting into the water system, maybe getting into smaller animals that these dogs and coyotes are eating and so forth.
Happening straight up at Chernobyl right now as we speak. There is a new genetic breed of dog that exists now specifically because of its proximity to the toxins of Chernobyl.
That's pretty wild. Well,
so what you're talking, and I mean, we know, we uncover more and more every year just epigenetically about human beings, Ken, and about how literally changing your diet will change the epigenetics of your son, your offspring, things like that. So if you think that environmental changes to a generation or two of animals will not offspring this stuff, I don't know. I guess I would beg to differ. Because it can happen pretty rapidly.
That's a great point, Christopher. Good knowledge that you're bringing in there.
This is fairly new information. Like, here it is from Smithsonian Magazine, talking about the stray dogs that they're finding at Chernobyl. It's pretty wild. This is all literally news from a month or so ago.
Wow.
So, yeah. Pretty interesting that you bring up the fact that it may be a genetic difference in the breed, something like that, especially due to pollutants in its environment.
Yeah, and I forgot to mention that, to your point, sulfur dioxide has been found to be a mutagen in laboratory rats.
Yep.
So it can actually alter the genetic code of lab animals. So,
absolutely.
So, yeah, these are weird, sad, kind of sad mutations, I think, diseased. Maybe the genetic changes are also making their immune systems weaker, which is causing the mange, when they have mange, to have a more severe impact on the physiology and things like that.
Yeah.
But who knows? These things are everywhere now, so I'm not surprised at all that there's one being photographed in Alabama. I've gotten pictures people have sent me from Maine, Tennessee, Mississippi, Missouri, pretty much all over the place. I think these things are kind of now it is alarming that there are so many of them all of a sudden. And I think, again, that points to environmental factors.
Exactly. I was just about to say the same thing. Just the fact that they are popping up more isn't necessarily the fact of, oh, people are out looking for them more, but more the fact of seems like they are breeding more.
Yeah. But, you know, it's still a bit of a mystery, I think. I don't think it's certainly not no longer considered a cryptid. Technically, it's not these things are cryptids. They're just they are mysterious, though. I think there are mysterious aspects to these animals for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And once again, especially their proliferation over the last few years, because, I mean, I remember when the first one was found, stuff like that. There have definitely been numerous sightings just over the last couple of years of things here in the Lone Star State. So
tons. Oh, and one last thing I should mention. Sure. This is interesting. Phyllis Canyon, who's often referred to as the Chupacabra Lady. She's the lady, a friend of mine down in Cuero, who has one of these things mounted in her living room. She's found two of them roadkill near her property. She has an interesting – she's a nutritionist, and she had an interesting theory about why these animals may in fact be maybe not sucking the blood but lapping up the blood of the animals they kill.
Sure.
And this could potentially be because they're anemic and they are suffering from iron deficiencies and other minerals, and therefore they may crave blood in terms of a nutritional supplement.
Yeah.
So it's kind of I like that kind of that outside of the box theory that maybe they are in fact lapping up blood from chickens and things.
And some animals just like it.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I prefer a rare to medium rare steak, as does my son. But I literally have one cat that will only eat steak or meat if it's cooked, and another one that will only eat it if it's raw. Once it's touched a pan, doesn't matter how much butter it has on it, whatever, zero interest. But while you're cutting that steak, like, wants chunks of raw meat. Pretty wild, both domestic cats.
No, that's true. So, and you're right. My family was kind of the same way. My dad, and this is a northern thing, but, you know, would always order the black and blue steak, which is basically just means lightly charred.
You can legally give it to
him. Lightly charred on the outside, but bloody and raw on the inside. Yeah. So that was a thing in my family as well. So,
well, you know, and the hypothesis that Phyllis puts out is a really, really good one to put out because, yeah. Things like that, any kind of illness, any kind of continued sickness along the bloodline, would definitely lead to such things. Feel free to, especially if you're talking about any kind of pure blood species that may not be crossbreeding, because of its deficiencies.
Absolutely.
You know, there wouldn't be a whole lot of strong crossbreeding going on because that's not really the desirable mate, you know, take a look at a Dalmatian breed, anything like that, that has been strong inbred. And yeah, you start getting deafness, blindness, anemia, all kinds of issues like that.
And I know we're kind of lingering on this subject, but you just reminded me because there are a lot of different interesting angles to this. I've had people contact me that have suggested that these animals may in fact be related to hairless breeds of dogs like Mexican Cholos.
Yep.
And I had a dog breeder near Austin, out near Elgin, a lady that breeds Peruvia Inca orchids, which are hairless dogs. She had me come out to her property one time to see her hairless dogs. And they do have some of the similarities in terms of the type of skin texture.
Mm-hmm.
They have whatever genetic condition that causes certain breeds of dogs to be hairless also gives them typically strange looking dentition known as scissor mouth. So their teeth are very weird looking. And she actually had a theory similar to that maybe some of these hairless dogs had escaped, not from her facility, but from another dog breeder and had been, you know,
crossbreeding with coyotes
and feral dogs. Yeah, basically
creating a new version of koi dog.
Exactly. And I still have people, and you know, in fact, this week someone just messaged me out of the blue and was like, "Hey, these things are Cholos, and they're very sure of them." It's an interesting theory, but we just don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you so much for your time to come on. We really do need to do something like this every few months, Ken, where it's just a cryptid news update.
You know, I always enjoy speaking with you, my friend.
Same. And I know you have tons of appearances coming up. We only have a couple minutes here left with you. Before we let you go, I want to give you time to shamelessly self-promote. Let everybody know where they can go to come out and meet you live, where they can go to buy your books, where they can go to follow all of the amazing adventures of Ken Gerhardt.
Well, I appreciate it, buddy. I have a website, kengerhardt.com. I'm also on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I have a YouTube channel. People can find my books on Amazon and eBay. In terms of appearances coming up, you're right. Things are getting kind of busy. But if anyone would like to come out and meet me, and I typically do lectures and presentations at these events, but I'll be at the East Tennessee Paracon in Morristown next weekend. I'll be at the West Texas Paracon on May 13th. That's out in Ballinger, kind of near Abilene. I'll be at the Kiamichi Mountain Bigfoot Festival in Tallahena, Oklahoma, also in May.
Oh, wow.
That's a new event as well. And West Virginia Bigfoot Festival. And, of course, one that we talked about that we're really excited about is the second Dogman Cryptid Conference, which is being held up in White Settlement, which is right near Lake Worth, Texas, home of the famous Lake Worth Monster or Goat Man. Yeah. And that's going to be Labor Day weekend. It's a 2-day event. Our friend Josh Turner and Paranormal Roundtable is a sponsor, and there's going to be 2 days of excellent presentations and lectures covering a whole range of cryptids and weird creatures.
Yeah, it's going to be a very, very epic event. I cannot wait for it. It's going to be awesome. Can't wait to see you there. I'm sure I'll be seeing you before then. But I want to thank you so much for the time, for coming on and telling the amazing story behind this envious prize that is now on my tchotchke shelf behind me. Hold the line real quick while we close.
Display it proudly.
I do. Anybody that asks, like, what's that about? I'm like, well, that is a purported chupacabra bone from an investigation.
Yep.
Yeah.
2012.
It's right back there next to my my lament cube from Hellraiser. So,
sweet.
All kinds of wild things can happen on that shelf. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience, Ken. While you are online checking out all the amazing work of King Gerhardt at kinggerhardt.com, make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com/store. That is, of course, another location where you can find all of the books from our guests. curiousrealm.com/video is our newly constructed or reconstructed videos page where we embed all of the channels of our guests. So stop on by curiousrealm.com/videos. Make sure to subscribe to King Gerhardt's content. Make sure to keep up with everything that he is doing, folks. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Keep your minds and hearts open. And until next time, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the knowledge vault on our website, curiousrealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.